I can't spell. I'm not a speller.
I can't either. No, feel bad.
What do we got going on here?
So we're going to do Minnesota.
I have turf in my shoes.
Well, that's unfortunate.
I'm sorry, from the football game last night. Would you like to begin?
Sure. We're going to do Minnesota, and I will just say up front that this one is a little different than any that I have researched before. It's kind of just a story. It's not, like, it's pretty linear. It's not a lot of different things happening. But I have to go ahead and credit up front before I forget this AmericanHeritage.com, because they had, like, a pretty well laid out research, and everything else that I did just kind of fell under that. So I just wanted to say that I did most of my research on that site before I start. In Minnesota, I didn't realize this, but at least at one point in time, there was a large, like, Swedish settlement.
Would have had no idea.
Red didn't know either. The Swedish farmer Olof Oman went to cut down a poplar tree on his land in Kensington, Minnesota, one day in 1898.
Okay.
Instead, he found tangled in the roots of the tree a large flat stone that had an unfamiliar script carved into it.
Time travelers.
I'm interested.
I'm here for it.
That's interesting.
I've been watching Outlander.
Okay. Oman called his neighbor over, and they started digging, and apparently thinking that they might find some buried treasure. What he discovered instead would come to be the most popular urban legend in Minnesota, which is known today as the Kensington Runestone. Mm-hmm. So do you know anything about it?
Runestone?
I've never heard of it, but I almost am wondering. I mean, I don't want to scoop you or go too far down the wrong trail, but Outlander is about time travel, mm-hmm. and there are stones used. They're not runes,
okay.
but there are stones used for time travel. And I always wonder when an author creates an entire world and runs a highly successful, like, where did that idea come from?
The inspiration.
Like, with Harry Potter, she looked up and saw a train.
Yeah.
And she thought about a kid going on a train to school. And that's where it all came from. But I'm like, I wonder if, like, Diana Gabaldon heard part of this and was like, oh, I could make, like, my own twist on this.
Yeah. I could take that and run with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's cool.
Okay. So the Kensington Runestone is a 202-pound gravestone-sized slab of, I think you say this gray wacky? I don't know.
200 pounds?
202.
God, I was thinking it was like a pebble.
No. It's large.
No.
Anyway, it's a hard gray sandstone. There are Scandinavian runes cut into it, and it is currently displayed at the Runestone Museum in Alexandria, Minnesota. So it's still around. Not only the source of Minnesota's most prominent urban legend, but it is also the subject of a great historical controversy. In 1968, Minnesota historian Theodore Blegen wrote that few questions in American history have stirred so much curiosity or provoked such extended discussions as the Kensington Runestone. It is an urban legend, and you'll kind of see how it unfolds, but it's also an actual thing. So it's, like I said, this one is different than any that we've done before, but it was the most popular, biggest thing, and, like, they've got a whole museum around it.
That's
so
cool. Let's go.
I thought it was interesting enough to go ahead and do.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like different.
Right, yeah. J.P. Hedberg was a resident of Kensington. He wrote a letter to the Swedish newspaper on New Year's Day in 1899, telling them about the discovery made by Olof Oman. He included a penciled copy of the 219 characters found on the stone and left it for the publisher, called Swan J. Turnblad. This is from his letter. Part of it said, I enclose you a copy of the inscription on a stone found about 2 miles from Kensington by O. Oman. He found it under a tree when grubbing. He wanted I should go out and look at it and told him to haul it in when he came, not thinking much of it. He did so, and this is the accessed copy of it. You perhaps have means to find out what it is. It appears to be old Greek letters. Yours truly, J.P. Hedberg. Which, the whole time I was researching this, every time I saw Hedberg, all I could think of was Mitch Hedberg.
Oh,
but that's beside the point.
I had trouble moving on from the fact that he was grubbing.
Yeah,
I
think it meant he was, like, because he was going to...
No, it means digging for grubs. That's nasty.
Well, but also it said, like, I read several times that he was going to cut down this tree, so I think there was, more to the story, probably.
Excavation.
Yeah, either way. Apparently, the inscription includes three Roman letters that form this symbol, the syllable AVM, which is interpreted as an invocation to the Virgin Mary. And many of the symbols resembled archaic Greek letters, similar to those found in the 19th century Bible aids. Most of the characters clearly showed the features of ancient Scandinavian runes. There was a fourth group that didn't seem to match any of these and were thought to be runes of a homegrown variety, but resembled numerals that looked to be Hindu and Arabic. So there's, like, I don't know if you're counting, but, like, four different languages on here at this point. So sidebar, just in case anybody doesn't know, because I heard the term runes a lot, but yeah. It helped to have, like, an actual, like, explanation of what they are. So they're characters of an ancient Scandinavian alphabet.
Okay.
And I think maybe not necessarily always Scandinavian, but in this case they were Scandinavian.
So there's nothing mystical about it.
It's just...
No, I don't think it's necessarily magical. Is that what you mean? Because I've heard it used as, like, magic bringers. Yeah, you'd see people, like,
read the runes or something that. Okay.
And that's why I was like, okay, what do we mean by runestones? Okay, so...
No, that's helpful.
Okay, I got you.
Examples occasionally date from the 4th and 5th centuries, but the majority of artifacts with these runes found on them are products of the Viking Age from the 8th to 11th centuries. And the Kensington Stone has the date on it, 1362.
That's an old stone.
Mm-hmm.
So Turnblad, who was, remember, the publisher, he sent the inscription that he had penciled onto the University of Minnesota to a professor of Norwegian descent whose name was O.J. Breda. Breda made a point to say that he was not an expert on the stone carvings or a runologist, but he knew enough of the runic alphabets to come up with a translation and was of the opinion that the message on the stone was not genuine.
Sidebar. What do you mean not genuine?
Like, he didn't think that they were actually ancient Scandinavian runes, which is what they had been interpreted as. So sorry, I probably didn't start that off well. There was a big like excitement about it, like, oh, this is ancient from Scandinavia, and he's basically saying, like, I don't think this is actually legit, like, what you false. Thought it was, correct?
Okay. What were you going to say there, Amanda?
No, I just wonder if Dad Ward has ever interviewed
done runology?
A runologist.
I thought that too.
Dad Ward?
Dad.
No.
It's from Ologies. Shout out. Best science podcast.
Anyway.
Real talk. Aaron's face.
Where was I? Oh, yeah. Not genuine. Okay. So... Breda recommended that the stone be studied by experts in runology, but his translation was published in the university student paper on January 14th, 1899 anyway, even though he said he wasn't an expert. A little over a month later, Turnblad's paper also published an article with the translation and discussed the possibility that it provided clues to the 14th century Scandinavian invasion of Minnesota. This was then published by several other Scandinavian and English language newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, and the doubt that O.J. Breda expressed about the authenticity of the runes was lost in all of the excitement. So when translated to English, this is what the inscription on the Kensington Stone is supposed to say. 8 Swedes and 22 Norwegians on an exploration journey from Vinland westward. We had our camp by 2 rocky islets? Islets?
Oh, you said that. Islets, probably. Islets,
okay. One day's journey north of this stone. We were out fishing one day. When we came home, we found 10 men with red and blood dead. AVM, save us from... AVM is the Roman... The Virgin Mary. Yeah.
To the Virgin Mary. Okay.
AVM, save us from evil. We have 10 men by the sea to look after our ships. 14 days journey from this island, year 1362. So what was...
A lot happening there.
Right. But, and, like, so why everybody was so excited is if the runestone was believed to be authentic, it meant that Vikings were in North America, not just along the shore, but as far inland as Minnesota.
Sure.
That's interesting.
A full 130 years before.
Which is a big deal because we all know, like, not to go way off track, but, like... Columbus is credited, right, with discovering the New World, but, like, we know that that's not true. So that's interesting to find some historical evidence.
Or remember the Phoenicians?
In parentheses here, I say, obviously, Columbus was not the first person to find North America.
Yeah.
I just read that over your... No, I didn't.
But at the time, that's what they had thought, and this was the only thing that was to contradict that so far.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's crazy.
So next, the stone was sent to Professor George O. Querme, I think is how you say this word. I have a hard time with this word. Mm. Philologist.
You're doing great.
Philologist at Northwestern University at Evanston in Illinois. And before you ask me, philology
is
the study of...
The phylos, obviously.
Study of the structure, historical development, and relationships of languages.
Yeah.
Which is probably a very interesting study.
I know, I was about to say.
What
I would
said.
Like to hear an ology episode on that, too. apparently, he entertained the idea that the stone was genuine upon inspection of the draft of the inscription, but when he was able to actually inspect the stone itself, he discovered that the carvings were lighter than the main surface of the stone, which was not consistent with the date 1362. So it was believed at that time that if the stone had survived more than 500 winters in Mississippi, Mississippi?
Minnesota.
You know, yeah, that state.
It's a hybrid state.
For the love. And Minnesota. It would not still show lines as true as those on a modern tombstone. So Querme said that whether it was authentic or not, the carver was very skilled at using a mallet and chisel, and he was not a runologist either, so he urged anyone who showed interest to send copies of the inscription to experts in runology at Scandinavian universities to get their judgments on the stone. So, in April of 1899, Amanda's excited. I thought this whole time I was doing this research, I was like, this should have been Amanda's. It's a whole history
it's
lesson.
It's all history. It's good.
But luckily for me, no evil spirits.
Yay.
It's nice to have a change.
It is, isn't it? I got to do Chessie and now this, so no telling what like my next state has
walking,
in store.
Walking ball of sunshine over here.
It's going to be like the worst next, the next one.
That's what I'm afraid of. Like, how's it going to come back on me?
That's right, you have 9 weeks now.
Yeah, that's right. In April of 1899, three professors of Christiana, which in parentheses it said Oslo University, so I think that may have been a former name, gave their verdict that the Kensington runestone was a clumsy forgery, and its author was a Swedish person with a basic grasp of runic letters. So at this point, many people suspected that Olaf himself had done it, since there were markings on some of the runes that were not consistent with the carvings left behind by the Vikings, but would have been familiar to someone who was born of more recent Swedish descent. Also, Olaf owned more than one book on runes, for what that's worth. There was an event in 1862 in Minnesota in which there was a Sioux uprising that left, this is just kind of a side note, that left several hundred white settlers, including many Scandinavians, at Norway Lake massacred, and could explain the red with blood and dead.
Mm-hmm.
This just is something that I thought that I didn't see that anybody else had kind of like thought about, but so 1862 is the year that that happened, and the date on the stone is 1362, and like if half of an 8 was smudged it would look like a 3.
That's,
you know what I mean,
so
like if
true.
It wasn't,
yeah,
so I just was like, well, maybe it was just misread all this time.
That happens all the time.
That's
it, really does. Historical interpretation,
right? But I didn't see that where anybody had like explored that idea, so that's just,
well, probably
just
someone's gonna listen to this podcast and realize what you've discovered, and you're probably gonna be on the national circuit in 6 or 8 weeks.
This is just my speed.
Yeah. Nothing you love more,
like
national attention.
Could you please just get off my lawn, thanks.
Can you please promote Salt the Pod though?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, please direct them back,
but listen to my podcast. So at this point, everybody's like, okay, it's a hoax. It was returned to Kensington and reclaimed by Olaf. So apparently he was pretty disappointed that he had discovered this hoax and promptly flung it down beside his granary.
Sounds like me on a casual
right.
Tuesday.
You know?
Right.
And he forgot about it altogether for a while.
I'm just imagining this angry... angry college professor throwing something down in a tantrum.
It's not a college professor. He was just, this guy was just the farmer who discovered it, and it's a 202-pound stone. So I'm like, how did he
just
fling it?
And forget it.
And forget it,
do
yeah.
not notice the 200-pound
stone.
It's
just there
stone.
By the granary. Don't mind that.
I still want to go with college professor. It works better for my mental image.
Oh, my God.
Whatever you need. Okay, so seems like that would be the end of the story, but there's more. Fast forward 8 years later, in the summer of 1907, which, another side note, may or may not have been the year that Granny was born.
Yeah.
Olaf was
you
paid.
Well, I'm like, does that mean you don't know if that's the year she was born?
No, her
no,
birth record was lost
know.
And she didn't
oh
remember.
Oh my God, I forgot
yeah.
that. Oh my God, I forgot
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so every time I see anything early 1900 anything, I'm always,
you
it
are
makes
exactly
me think of Granny.
Right. She didn't know how old she was.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, sorry.
So,
she's like, what?
Both of our mothers are rolling their eyes dramatically right now.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom's probably laughing. So in 1907, Olaf was paid a visit by a fellow Scandinavian from Wisconsin named, I'm going to definitely butcher this name, Hjalmar Ruud Holland.
You did great. Hey. You did great.
I don't know if that's right or not. Holland, or Holland possibly, was a historian and author, and he had come to inspect the stone on his quest to confirm his projected history of Norwegian settlements. No one really knows what happened between the two men, but some people seem to speculate that he possibly sold it to, that Olaf possibly sold it to Holland for $10.
Mm, I see.
Right, because, you know, massive
cash.
Stone, $10.
Why not? Get it off my lawn.
Here you are. Yeah, exactly. But Holland ended up leaving the leaving Kensington with the stone, and within a year, he had published a book which featured none other than the Kensington runestone.
Definitely.
In 1911, he toured Europe with the stone after trying and failing to sell it to the Minnesota.
With the stone? How do you travel?
With the 202-pound stone, right?
Okay.
You get a really big wagon.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Multiple oxen.
Wagon.
To get you around to Europe from Minnesota.
It's a long drive, but you got to be tenacious.
He tried to sell it to the Minnesota Historical Society for $6,000. Didn't work out. That was a lot of money at the time, even for something that wasn't contested.
Still a lot of money. Yeah, I was about to say.
It's true. Yeah, but think about that. Somebody would throw around $6,000 now easier than then.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But I wouldn't, like, turn my nose
you
up
wouldn't pay
at
it
six
for a
grand.
So the sale never took place, but the Historical Society did end up publishing a report endorsing the stone to be genuine. Apparently, they did so even without the support of experts, so many scholars in both Europe and the States continued to dismiss it as a hoax. But it is said that there was a committee of people from the Historical Society, and it is said that no one on the committee that wrote the report had any prior knowledge of Scandinavian linguistics. But the report contained considerable detail on the topic anyway, so it still seems kind of like, okay, what's happening here?
Mm-hmm.
It was almost 40 years later when it was discovered that most of the report was the work of Holland. It was discovered that the author wrote a letter in 1910 to the committee after having made this discovery himself, stating, "In as much as your answer to the linguistic objections is in the main copy from my dissertation, I think it proper that you make suitable acknowledgement." So they basically like lifted his research and published it.
Oh, dang.
Sounds familiar. Right.
Okay, so thinking about the time that we're in at this point, World War I came along and took attention away from the whole thing, because obviously people had other things to worry about at this time.
Right.
But once the world entered back into peacetime, Holland brought his attention right back to the fight to prove that the Kensington runestone was authentic.
Like, no.
Yeah, he's like, okay, now that the war's over. to prove that the Kensington runestone was authentic and proved Vikings had been in North America around the year 1362. He has claimed that the stone is the oldest document in American history, and he was willing to take on anyone who disputed him on the matter.
Hmm.
Ethnologists supported Holland's claims to the extent of putting the runestone on display at the Smithsonian in 1949. There is a runestone memorial park in Alexandria, Minnesota that was created in 1951 when a giant replica of the original stone was placed and unveiled in a public ceremony. Oh, at some point, I don't know why I forgot to actually finish the sentence, but I think I was writing there. At some point, it was actually at the Chicago World Fair.
Oh,
well.
That would make cool. Sense. Yeah, that's cool.
But now I don't have the year because I forgot to finish that sentence. I probably was researching in one place and then went to another place and just forgot to go back to it.
Sounds like my everyday.
Holland was delighted at this. He was delighted at all of this attention until a lawsuit came about which attempted to determine who properly owned the stone.
Uh-oh.
Three people, not sure of their names, just found three people and their heirs attempted to lay claim to the stone, saying that they had given Holland purchase money, around a total of $2,500, and Holland disputed this claim, saying that the money he had been given was scholarship money to study abroad, which I'm like, can I please study abroad for $2,500?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no joke.
Meanwhile, Olaf, remember Olaf the farmer who...
Olaf is my favorite person in this story.
Yeah, who is not a professor.
Well, he may not be a professor, but every
or
time you say
he?
Olaf, I imagine the snowman.
Yeah.
So.
I hear Berserker.
Yes, me too.
From your husband. Yes.
From Jay and Silent Bob, yes.
Yes.
Olaf's family maintained that he, who had since died in 1935, had never received a cent of payment for the stone, so maybe not the $10 after all.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say,
that
what
was
happened?
Just a rumor. It was, I don't know why. It never said why. Just some people said maybe they sold it for $10. It's like, I don't know where that came from.
That's what, like, messy little townspeople do is they just make stuff up.
So,
those messy
townspeople. I love it. That's my favorite thing Tammy's ever said is messy little townspeople.
Messy little townspeople are often responsible for urban legends, I think.
Yeah, that's so true.
Correct.
So he said, yeah, they said he never got payment for the stone. The lawsuit, for some unknown reason, though, was apparently postponed abruptly without explanation. And once again, talk of the stone went quiet for a while until Holland, who was like a dog with a bone, did not give up and published another book in 1956, which again had, you know, the stone had a starring role in it. So I'm just going to pause here and I just want to know, what do you think at this point?
There is so much detail that I feel like I'm having to listen and think and process at the same time. There's a lot of...
And I'm trying to talk fast so we don't go on for hours.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, she's almost done. Then I was like, shh. Got 17 pages left.
I think Holland I don't know.
Well, he's definitely, like, whether the runestone is real or not real, this Holland,
mm-hmm.
Homan guy.
Wow.
I probably should cut that out. He's definitely exploiting it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if I think it's real or not real, but he definitely has seen an opportunity.
His motives, right.
Yes. Yeah, he has seen an opportunity to propel himself to a national or international
right.
profile, mm-hmm. and he's using this as a vehicle.
I think that's a fair assessment mm-hmm. at this stage.
Yeah.
So do you think it's real?
I want to say yes.
Okay. I also want to say yes, but I always want right. to go on the side of the legend.
Exactly.
So my next note says, so Holland obviously felt very strongly about the legitimacy of the runestone. and it makes sense that he had a mass public following because these things mm-hmm. happen. Like if you right. say something with your chest, people are going to listen.
Yeah, for sure.
Many scholars of distinction apparently either supported or at least gave pause to entertain Holland's teaching. So there was some that said mm-hmm. no, some that said yes. There have also been many scholars who were impressed with his work and had confidence in it, saying that they were not in a position to evaluate it in its entirety, but found that there could be truth to it. So remember, his whole thing was that he was proving the Vikings traveling to North America.
Yeah.
So they found, like, runestone aside, they found value in his work. Holland's main argument was that no valid arguments can be brought against this runic stone, so therefore it's true.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Sure.
So linguists have said that he has no ability to make claims about linguistic data, but are compelled by his geographical research and history that he traced, and historians doubted his ability as a historian, but were impressed by his linguistic claims. So at this stage, it kind of sounds like he's full of it, right?
Yeah, well, it sounds like you have two sets of experts
mm-hmm.
who are like, right, well, you don't know anything about my field, but you're super good at that other field, right. So they're all just pointing fingers at each other.
Right, exactly. Okay, so we've pretty much talked about the linguistic problems with, like, why this wouldn't be legitimate. So there's a couple of other things that make it controversial. The age and weathering is one of the main ones. So Olaf claimed to have found the stone in 1898, and it was suggested that the stone was then 70 years old. So the tree that it was tangled in, it was tangled in the roots of, must have been growing over it since 1828, which would have been at least a generation earlier than the Scandinavian settlement that Olaf lived in. But no one except for the Omen family and the one neighbor even saw the tree since it was dug up before the inspection crew or the party of local residents came to the site 8 months later looking for the buried treasure. Someone from that crowd estimated that the tree was about 12 years old, and based on the size of the hole and the roots from where it was dug up, and the other trees that were cut down in the area were aged around 30 to 40 years. So if it was actually 70 years old, it was the oldest tree in mm-hmm. a bunch of similar trees.
Okay.
Okay, so I know that was kind of confusing, but remember that Olaf claims to have discovered the stone in 1898,
mm-hmm.
but J.P. Hedberg, who was the publisher that sent off the inscription, was the first person recorded to have seen it since the inscription, and remember that was on New Year's Day. So basically there were several months between when he said he discovered the stone
mm-hmm.
and the next person saw it.
So Olaf could be full of it.
Well, some people think that.
Olaf, the non-professor?
The non-professor.
Professor Farmer.
The non-professor farmer liar.
Dr. Farmer.
Dr. Farmer. Start calling Doc that.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Dr. Farmer.
He'd love it.
So, obviously, that was plenty of time for him to have created the inscription himself. It was estimated by experts that doing an actual inscription like that, like carving it in, would take someone less than a day. I kind of have my doubts, though, that it looked very aged at all at that point. So, like, it didn't look brand new, but it looked a little bit, like, it didn't look as old as it should have for what they were claiming, basically.
Right.
So, it's all very fuzzy. Anyway, in 1910, which, remember, would be 12 years later from when it was discovered, Professor Winchell, who was a geologist, I didn't find Professor Winchell's first name, which I thought was very odd, but he made the claim that the aging of the stone looked to be about 15 years, maybe 30, but closer to 15. He said that one of two things happened with the stone. It was normally exposed to the elements and was truly less than 30 years old, or it had been buried underground, face down, since its claimed origin date in 1362, which could have preserved it. Apparently, geology is an exact science, and there were believed to be no other alternative. So it was either one of those two things. Depending on what you believe, you could argue either way still.
So we're thinking Dr. Farmer had all this free time mm-hmm. to create this narrative and carve a fake runestone.
Some people do.
I believe in Olaf.
Okay.
I believe in Olaf.
You're still Olaf's friend.
I'm team Olaf here.
Okay.
A college professor.
Professor Farmer.
I have a soft spot for professors.
You know. Okay. So then the next question would be the history. So Holland's research. His research revolved around the party. Okay. So here's the thing. There's possibly, maybe or not, a party that was sent to Greenland from Norway in the year 1355 under a Captain Paul Knutsen. And this was what he presented in his research, which is why the story is relevant. The party was sent by King Magnus Eriksson, a.k.a. Smek, which I included because I like the nickname Smek.
Sure, why not?
Smek.
Who was the ruler of Sweden and Norway?
Smekky Smek Smek.
Uh-huh. The party was sent on a royal expedition to save the Christian faith among the Scandinavian colonials of Greenland who had become disheartened. So I think they were just, it was like, they had run into some trouble and the king was like, hey, go help them out so that they don't lose their faith.
Go bring them back to the church.
Yeah. The only known reference of this voyage can apparently be found in a 16th century abridged letter sent in the name of King Magnus by his regent in Norway, Orm Ostensen.
Mm-hmm.
The letter is said to have commanded Knutsen to gather a crew to sail for Greenland and nothing else. So, and it was in 1355. So it is also known that, so basically all that did was prove that maybe he sent a party to Greenland. Doesn't really prove that he came all the way to America at this
right.
stage.
Mm-hmm. And Minnesota's not that close to Greenland.
Mm-hmm. It's not. So it is also...
It's not.
It's also known, apparently, that all attempted sailings to the west in that year were driven back. I guess other records indicate that anybody else who tried to travel west in that year were driven back by continuous storms, which makes the idea that anyone made it as far to as North America unlikely.
Right.
We also know that King Magnus turned over the throne to his son, Prince Hakon, which means that the new king would have had to approve of the mission, and apparently Orm Ostensen, who wrote the letter, his status was at this time declined, and he was imprisoned and executed. So there's all kinds of questions as to whether this mission actually happened or not. There was a civil war in Norway and Sweden in which another of Magnus's sons, Prince Eric, revolted and declared himself king in 1356. And Eric died in 1359, at which time there were still troubles among the monarchy, which makes this expedition unlikely.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, with all this crazy stuff going on, possibly they were just like, if people did leave to head for North America, maybe they're just running away from like a troubled area.
It's totally possible.
But Holland's research and theories put Captain Knutsen in the Hudson Bay after searching unsuccessfully for 7 years for the lost Greenlanders. So that's what his theory was, that they made it to America accidentally.
Mm-hmm. Which also makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I think that was, I mean, it's not like they had, you know, Google Earth or anything
right,
like that. It's
right.
like, I'm going for this thing and my directions are a little imprecise and now right. I'm here, so let's figure this out.
Right, exactly. So he states that the Norse seafarers at this point abandoned their vessels and plunged into the mouth of the Nelson River, which presumably, by the way, I'm guessing by canoe, brought them to Lake Winnipeg, the Red River of the North, and then Lake Cormont in Minnesota.
Okay.
From here, they would have gone through a marshy swamp to arrive where he said they carved the runestone. Remember from the inscription, they're supposed to have been 14 days from the sea, according to the inscription. So for lots of geographical and scientific reasons that I won't dissect because it would take a very long time and we probably wouldn't understand it all anyway, apparently it seemed to be an impossible trip that you could make in 14 days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if it's a hoax, who did it and why? At the time, well, we'll find out about your friend Olaf.
I love Olaf.
At the time that...
I'll cut that out if he's a baddie. If he's a baddie.
You have to cut out a lot of you loving Olaf. No. It's really not, I mean, like... Okay, let's finish this.
Okay, let's do this.
At the time that the runestone was discovered, and in the time after when its authenticity was being debated for apparently forever, Leif Erikson, I don't know if you guys remember him from history class.
Yes.
Leif Erikson day.
Okay, so distinctly remember him.
His journey to North America was being widely discussed, and there was a renewed interest in the Vikings throughout Scandinavia. So this was just a very hot topic at the time, as hot as a topic can be worldwide in 1900-something.
Mm. 1900.
How did topics become worldwide topics in 1900-something?
I guess by boat and letter. Okay. Is my guess.
Carrier pigeon, mm-hmm. maybe?
It's not. It's probably not.
Owls.
It's not the internet.
No, I hear it's that not the Al Twitter. Gore invented that.
Okay, all right. Erikson is believed to have been the first European to have come to settle in North America, not counting Greenland. It is not beyond the realm of possibility that a settler in Minnesota who was looking for belonging and proud of their Nordic heritage would create such a hoax.
Yeah.
Many immigrant groups were eager to show that they belonged in a new chosen land, which in many ways I think we can still relate to today is still kind of a thing.
Definitely.
Some people that the rune Some people believe that the stone was created as a way to show that they belonged by showing that people from their homeland were there for hundreds of years before the British.
So, yeah, I could see that.
It could be true, it could not be true, but that's kind of like the explanation for why he would have done it, because he never really sought, like you made the point that, now I've forgotten his name, even though I said it 1,400 times.
Olaf?
No, not Olaf. The, oh lord.
The traveling salesman. Holland?
Yes, Holland, thank you. He obviously was trying to make money off of it. Yeah. Olaf never tried to make any money off of it, so if he did do it, which we'd have no idea if he did or not, it may have just been for a sense of belonging.
Or something that got completely out of hand.
True.
Right. Like, it's like, right, you try this thing and a couple of people believe you, and suddenly the lie is so large that you can't own up to it. And it, like, it outlived him, kind of thing.
Right. There. And here we are on Salt the Pod.
100 million years later.
Talking about old Olaf.
Oh, Olaf.
Team Olaf for the win.
You can still like him.
I do like him. I like Professor Olaf.
So, whether you believe the legend or not, the Kensington Runestone is well known and currently resides in the Runestone Museum, which is downtown. Yeah, I would visit.
I would go see it too, for sure.
At this point, no reason to not visit Minnesota.
There were no spookies. Spookies. I was going to say spooky ghosts.
Yeah, there's not even a ghost attached to the Runestone.
I forgot to finish the sentence.
No spookies.
No spookies. Kind of like when you know how I was talking about how Chessie was widely used as kind of like a symbol of the area.
Yeah.
Many businesses in this area also use the Runestone or a Viking as an identifying symbol. Like, if you'll notice, Minnesota's NFL team is also called the Vikings.
Yeah.
In case you were not aware of that.
No, man, on the Minnesota Vikings.
I made a thought to pause for you to do that while I was writing these notes.
Don't look at me like that. Lizzo is bomb.
I do love her.
Yeah.
Apparently. You can also visit the Omen Farm if you're in the area, which would be fun. So we can visit your friend Olaf's place.
I would happily go visit Olaf.
Maybe the ghost of my Olaf respects. Is there.
Apparition. They prefer apparition.
The apparition. It's just a short drive from the museum in Kensington Park. So a lot of people still leave the museum confused about what to believe and write it off as a hoax. And those who have an interest in the Runestone apparently usually have a very strong opinion one way or the other about it, which leads to some very heated arguments. Mm. So it can be quite the hot topic. There was another website, thekensingtonrunestone.com, that I did not explore in its entirety because there were lots of explanations and theories that I could not keep this one episode if I had gone into. Yeah. But there's more information there if anyone wants to take a look at some of the ideas.
So before we visit, we have to make a stance. We have to have an opinion. We need to go in
so we can have hot debates.
Yeah.
I have an important question.
Sure.
What is the local high school called? Like, what's the town or the local high school?
I didn't look that up, but I would not be surprised if it was Viking.
Well, because I deeply love...
high school football.
Well, I do deeply love high school football, but even more possibly than that is when people pick their mascots. Because I listen to My Favorite Murder, and they're always like, oh, yeah, and the Fighting Bassoons. I mean, they pick these ridiculous, like... football names, right? Uh-huh. So, like, I want this to be the town of the, like, Angry Runestones. Like, I want that to be their high school mascot.
You don't want it to be the Doc Farmer to be the mascot?
Look, I think Dr. Farmer is an excellent choice, but Angry Runestones,
the Olaf.
That's just got more power on the football field.
It does.
It's more intimidating.
It's unmovable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard...
It's
a hard line to cross.
Oh, yeah, we're done.
Thanks for listening to Salt Over Your Shoulder, a Redwater production. We appreciate your support. Your download allowed our crazy idea to gain steam and make it into your podcast directories. We couldn't do this without you. If you'd like to continue your support, you can engage with us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram at SaltThePod, or follow us on Facebook at SaltOverYourShoulder. You can also email us at saltoveryourshoulder@gmail.com.
Special thanks to the one and only Andrew York for our awesome graphic.
If you'd like to continue your support, please consider giving us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast directory. This helps other people find us as well. You can also become one of our patrons at patreon.com.